Hey guys, welcome to episode 49 of the Historic Performance Podcast featuring Dr. Tim Gabbett. Today's episode is a little different from previous episodes. It's more question answer. And the reason for that is that prior to the podcast, I knew there was a lot of interest in this simply from the response that I got when I mentioned that Dr. Tim Gabbett was coming on the podcast. So I opened it up to listener questions via Facebook, email, and Twitter. There was an overwhelming response, so I wanted to make sure that I included the majority of the questions within the episode, and I hope that the answers not only answer the questions that the listener submitted, but overall you learn from them. Before getting to the interview with Dr. Tim Gabbett, I want to take the time to thank all of you that support and listen to the Historic Performance Podcast. I started the podcast 6 months ago, and I never would have imagined that in 1 month I would have had over 10,000 downloads, and that's what happened in the month of April. None of this would be possible without all of you, and it's a real testament to the community, the sports science community, and the strength and conditioning community that so many people are interested in continuing education, trying to better themselves every single day, and trying to refine and hone their skills. As such, the only thing I've always asked from every single one of you that listen to this podcast is if you think the content is good, please make sure to share it with your colleagues. It only helps us grow as a community and become stronger. While we're on that topic, I mentioned last week that there's a great continuing education opportunity in the Global Performance Summit. It's an online summit that's taking place between May 9th and the 16th. It's featuring some great guests, including Dan John, Scott Irdella, Nick Winkleman, Dr. Mike Young, Dr. Mario Novo, and the list really goes on. There's going to be some great presentations, and the best part of it is that it's absolutely free. You just need to sign up by submitting your email address on globalperformancesummit.com, and I think you're really going to learn a lot from it. Having said all of that, I hope you enjoy this episode. Let's get started. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm really happy to be joined today by Dr. Tim Gabbett. I know it's been a little bit of a while in order to schedule this, but I'm finally glad to have you on. As I mentioned, there's a lot of listeners who sent in questions to be answered. So Dr. Gabbett, it's a pleasure having you on. Welcome.
Thanks very much, James. It's really cool to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
No, the pleasure is all mine. Dr. Gabbett, in order to start off, I usually like to start off the podcast with the guests giving a little bit of background and how their career journey progressed. So if you could just give us a little bit of background about yourself, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. I've always been involved in sport. I played sport all my life. I was naturally going to end up or sort of be attracted to that as a career. When I first studied, I ended up going down a path that was more of a clinical based path. So I ended up doing a lot of cardiovascular research and blood pressure type research, and my early research was done in that area, but I was always doing sport work, while I was doing that research and always researching sport when I was doing that other research. So it was only natural for me to, once I finished that cardiovascular research, to get back into sport work and sport research. So over the last 20 years, that's what I've been doing predominantly, is just working with in a high performance sports settings and just trying to be really applied in what I do.
I know at least in most recent times, one of the talks that you gave over at Aspire Academy had to do with acute to chronic workload ratio. I was just wondering what kind of made you interested in exploring and researching ways to not only create an injury predictor model, but delve into the research of acute to chronic workload.
Look, in terms of your first question, in terms of the injury prediction stuff, it was, I guess, part of my job is just is to identify different problems that the sports are having. So if I'm working with a sport and you're immersed in a sport, your little challenges come up along the way, and you've got to try and find solutions to those challenges, solutions to those problems. And so questions come up all the time. And one of the questions, one of the big questions, is can we minimize some of our non-contact soft tissue injuries, or, you know, some of these preventable injuries, can we reduce those down so we get more of our best players available selection each week? So one of the big things that we looked at was load and injury, and it just sort of grew from there. We identified some associations, some relationships between load and injury, and then we thought, well, if there's a relationship between load and injury, can we actually use load information to reduce some of those injuries? And then, you know, the final point from that was just developing a little model or identifying the accuracy of that model, and that's where the prediction stuff comes in. And keep in mind, with prediction, it's I've said this before, it's not that we consider ourselves Nostradamus and that we can predict the future. It's just the probability of injury. So when we talk about injury prediction, it's the likelihood of injury or the probability of injury. So we can say, based on a certain load information, this is your probability of becoming injured. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's definitely going to result in injury. So risk doesn't equal rate. And in terms of the acute and chronic workload information, that's a really good question as well, because what I was seeing, I'd trained a lot and trained a lot of different athletes, and what I was hearing a lot of was that whenever players were fatigued, it was load. Whenever players were injured, it was load. Whenever players were performing poorly, it was load. So load was just considered this terrible thing, you know, that it was something that we almost had to stay away from at all costs. So part of the acute chronic workload modeling is just bringing or swinging the pendulum back to where it should be, that not all load can be bad. A lot of training load is really, really good, and there's a lot of benefits that come from training hard, just as long as that you train smart with it. So that's pretty much how we went about the acute chronic load problem, is just trying to get the balance right with training load, and identifying the positives and the negatives that come with training.
Since we're on that topic now, I actually have a bunch of questions from the listeners, like I mentioned earlier on. The first one I have is from Michael, and I'm not going to be saying last names because I don't want to butcher any last names here. Michael's question is, how would you prepare for unavoidable spike in training load? And as an example, multiple games in a short period of time. Do you recommend decreasing training load to lower the spike, or increasing training load as a quote-unquote preload?
Yeah, look, it's I guess before we'd done our recent work, Billy Hewlin's done some really, really good work with his masters, and one of the projects there was to look at the relationship between short and longer turnaround times, but also how training load interacts with that. And before we'd done that work, we probably would have said, when you see a spike that's about to occur, so when you know you're leading into multiple games, then just unload into those multiple games, the congested schedules, and then you can, you know, you're fresh leading into that spike in load. We would still recommend that, but what we would probably suggest now is that in the 4 weeks leading into that congested schedule, you typically know that it's coming. So we would preload. And I'm not saying that we go excessive with our training loads so that we put our players in a hole for that 3 or 4 week period before the congestion. What we do is just increase loads a little bit. So what that allows you to do is to increase your chronic load so that any spike is a smaller relative spike. It comes on the back of higher chronic loads. And we know that higher chronic loads are protective against injury. And the benefits of the higher chronic loads is it's much higher to spike on top of high loads than it is on low loads. So that's another benefit of the preload.
Would you typically suggest, so let's say that 4 weeks out, do this quote-unquote preload where you're increasing load a little bit, as you mentioned, in order to decrease the amount of spike that's going to happen with the chronic load. But do you still want to have a slight deload the week leading up to that congested fixture schedule?
Yeah, we would. We would look to the preload. We'd still look to try and keep our players in a relative sweet spot in terms of the acute chronic workload ratio. So we've roughly defined that sweet spot as between 0.8 and 1.3 as a ratio. So as we're preloading, as we're increasing load, we'll try and increase load enough to increase chronic load, but not so much that we're spiking loads within that 4 week preload period. And then as we unload, we don't look for large fluctuations or large troughs in load either. So we try and just have smaller fluctuations in load when we're increasing and when we're decreasing. So when we unload our players, we'll try and keep that unload within that range of sort of 0.8. Once we go below that, once we get into about a 0.5, we know we get some performance benefits from big unloads, but we also know that when we unload and have large troughs in training load, what we can find is that the injury risk increases as well. So we try and keep the fluctuations in load quite small. It seems from an injury perspective that the body seems to be able to handle small fluctuations in load much better than it handles large fluctuations in load.
I think this is actually a pretty good segue into the second question, and this is from Ronan. And he said, for players that currently have a chronic load of zero, how aggressively do you want to nudge them back towards match fitness?
It's a hard question to answer because it depends on the player and where they've accrued zero load. So, and if you've got a player who's quite a robust, resilient player who's shown repeatedly and consistently that they can handle load, then you might be more aggressive with them. Other players who have repeatedly shown that they have high injury risk at even low loads, then you need to be a little bit more cautious with them. It depends a little bit on the injury as well. So some injuries I think you can probably be more aggressive with. Some injuries you just can't. And when you're bringing a player back from injury, you need to be respectful of physiological healing times. We know that some injuries, say a broken bone, might take six weeks to heal. There's not much we can do about the physiological healing time for a broken bone. It is what it is. Same with some, with a hamstring injury. If you have a serious enough hamstring injury, you can't cheat healing time there. Whereas other injuries, say you've got an ankle sprain, you might be able to cheat that healing time a little bit by wrapping it up in a lot of tape. So it depends a little bit on the injury, and it depends a lot on the person as well. What I would try and suggest is that just because a player is injured, that doesn't mean they have to fall to zero either. So what we would try and do is look more at, don't tell me so much what the player can't do, tell me what he can do. And then we find ways to try and keep load into the player based around what he can do. So he might not be able to run, but there's a whole heap of other training activities that we can do with that player to ensure that we keep at least the internal loads up. So his high-speed running load may drop to zero, but his internal load can be still quite high, and we can manage to keep his internal loads up around where he would normally be at through a whole heap of other training activities. So and in terms of injury, I think we also need to try and keep or try and get players moving as soon as practical following injuries. So there may be a player with a hamstring injury, and with hamstring injuries you obviously can't do high speed running, but there's a whole heap of other things you can do. So you can still move at the intensity of a game, even though it might only be jogging intensity. You can still cover 100 meters per minute in jogging, or so you don't have to be doing high speed running initially, but we do want to try and keep the player moving and get them moving as quickly as possible. One of the benefits is that it allows us to keep their chronic load up, so that when we are bringing them back, we don't have to spike them towards the end of their rehab period. But the second is that they'll just be feeling a lot better about themselves if they're moving. They'll be feeling a lot more normal if we can keep them moving and keep some load into them rather than just dropping them to zero.
At least that's my understanding, because I recently read a article that Jo Klubb wrote, that she wrote, and she was talking about kind of the chronic rehabber. So the person who gets injured, he has a large spike in load, gets injured again, they spike them again, and it just becomes this endless circle. So is this where, as you mentioned, trying to get some activity ultimately help in the endeavor of getting a player back to match fitness?
Part of the problem with the chronic rehabber is it's a little bit of chicken or egg. It's hard to know whether they got injured in the first place because they just weren't able to get high enough loads to protect them from injury. So typically what happens is they get exposed to low loads. And one of the issues with being exposed to low loads is that it increases your risk of injury. And the problem then is once you've had one injury, it increases your risk of a subsequent injury. We know that the biggest predictor of injury is the fact that you've been injured before. So then they end up going through a bit of a feedback loop. That's what we talk about with the constant rehabber, is that you start on low loads, you get injured, which increases your risk of subsequent injury, and then you go back through that loop of, okay, I'm back in the rehab loop, and these athletes never get high enough loads that actually protect them against injury. So it may be that they get rushed back, or they just the loads in rehab are just not high enough, and then when exposed to higher loads, they break down again. And you could think of any team, pretty much anywhere in the world, or anyone who's listening to this podcast who works with a team, can identify the constant rehabber in that team. That it's just someone who just never seems to be able to get out of rehab. They frustrate the team because they're a valuable part of the team, but they just keep breaking down. And a big part of that is that they've just never able to get high enough loads to protect them against injury.
Moving on to the third question, and this is a question by Jason, and he said, in your research, have you found any correlation between the monotony of load and injury?
No, we haven't actually. I think maybe in our really early work, we might have found some, a correlation between monotony and injury, but the vast majority of our work has been load has been a really good. Has been a really good predictor, if you like, or has been most associated with injury. When you're using multiple sessions in a day, the monotony and strain values become a little harder to calculate, because they were initially developed based on one session a day, and when you're in elite sport, you can be training up to four times in a day, so it becomes a little harder to to develop those monotony values and create and interpret those monotony values. But yeah, as I say, most of our work has shown such a strong relationship between load and injury that we've really focused on the training load score. There's other ways to look at where, you know, the distribution of load within a week other than monotony, and that's we use sort of different approaches other than monotony and strain for that.
The next question that I have is from Dan. You stated in your recent Aspire Academy presentation that your injury prediction model was better suited to predict true negatives. How do you feel it can be improved to predict true positives?
Look, I wonder whether we really want it to predict true positives. You know, in some respects, the reason it was not so good at predicting true positives was probably because we didn't have a lot of true positives. You know, I think from memory we only had 20 over a 2-year period, which is quite small in relation to the, you know, couple of thousand true negatives we had. There's a few reasons in that particular work why we had so few true positives, and part of it was I just don't know that we were training hard enough to sustain a training load related injury. And if you think about it, if you constantly have a focus on your players where you're constantly managing them away from their training load threshold, and you're constantly worried about injury rather than performance, then what actually happens is you never actually train hard enough to sustain a training load related injury. But the flip side of that is that you never actually train hard enough to develop any physical qualities that can actually protect you against injury. And if you have such a focus on managing players away from load all the time to try and their load injury threshold to try and prevent injuries, then of course you're going to have a lot more true negatives than you will true positives. I actually think if you can use those dose response relationships like we did for our players. So we had a dose response curve, but each player had their own individual dose response curve. Some had really flat curves, which means they can handle a lot of load and their injury risk is low. And other players have really steep curves, which means that at really low loads, they have a really high risk of injury. But if you can manage your players individually using their own individual curves, if you can use the acute chronic workload ratio and gently, safely nudge them a little bit harder, push them a little bit harder, pull back, push them a little bit harder, so that you're actually trying to improve their resilience. What I think will happen is that you will shift those dose response curves to the right, and the dose response curves will flatten out as well, which means that your players are becoming more robust, they're becoming more resilient. So you're not worrying so much about identifying true positives and, an injury might happen. What you're actually concerning yourself with is just developing a really resilient athlete. So that's essentially what we're trying to do with training, to train our players to become robust, to handle load, to tolerate the demands of the game. So that's where I think our focus really should be, is not so much identifying the true positives, but trying to shift that curve to the right. So we're actually developing a really robust, resilient player.
I actually just realized when I asked that question that we didn't actually discuss what body of work this was in and what is a true positive and true negative for someone who hasn't watched that presentation.
Essentially, this was something that was published in 2010, and we, over a 2-year period, we looked at the relationship between load and injury, and then over a second 2-year period, we used that load information to try and identify players who were at risk of injury based on their load their load data. So what it enables you to do is identify true positives and negatives, false positives and negatives. So a true positive is when based on your load information, you predict that someone's going to get injured and they get injured. A true negative is when you say that an injury won't occur and it doesn't. A false negative is when you say an injury will occur based on the load information and it doesn't. And then a false positive is when, based on load information, you say an injury is going to happen. You predict an injury is going to happen based on their load information, but nothing happens. And then what you're able to do then is calculate sensitivity and specificity, which is essentially the accuracy of the model. And our accuracy was really good when a player went over their load injury threshold, they were injured 70 times more often. And when they were under that load threshold, they were injured 1/10 of the time. So from a predictive point of view, this load monitoring system was quite effective.
Getting away from some of the audience questions, I actually have a question of my own. Recently, I was at a conference, and there's a lot of young strength coaches and some who wanted to learn a little bit more about sports science. And one of them said to me, and I thought it was a pretty good question, he's like, when it comes to sports science, people are collecting data and then they're analyzing it. He goes, but how do I figure out what questions I want to ask so that when I'm collecting the data, I know what questions I'm trying to answer? And he said, at least for me, I'm 23 years old and I don't really know how to go about doing that. And I know that you've been at this for the past 20 years. You've done tons of research. How do you go about formulating questions in terms of what you want to research or when you get a consultant role, what types of questions you want to answer within that particular team?
Yeah, that really is a good question. It's the question that everyone should be asking themselves when they go into sport. What I would suggest you do before you collect any data is actually work out your question, because unless you've worked out your question, then your data isn't data, it's just numbers. And you're actually collecting numbers looking for a question. So when you first go into a role, the obvious thing that you think, oh well, I'm employed as a sports scientist. I'm employed to try and make sense of the data that we're collecting. So, I've got to start analysing it. What I'd suggest you do is just take an extra period of time. Now, it doesn't have to be a year, but take a few days to a few weeks getting the lay of the land at the team that you're with. And what that means is just walking around having conversations with people. So start with the assistant coaches, and talk to them about what they're working on at the moment, what they're seeing when they're seeing the team play, or what they're thinking about the training. If you get a chance to have a discussion with the head coach, then just stand with him at training. So when training is going on, just stand next to him and listen to the way he talks to the players. Occasionally he'll say something to you, but just shadow him, follow him around for a little bit and listen to what he's saying. And that actually informs you a lot more than trying to work out anything from the numbers when you're trying to find a question, because you actually don't know what to be looking for. Once you start listening to the coach, you start understanding what his real issues are in terms of the challenges he's dealing with. And then, the last thing is make sure you have conversations with the players. Get a feel for how they think and what they think about the game and what they think their biggest issues are. If you ask these sort of questions, you sit down with people, or you just follow them around and listen to the way they speak, and they'll throw you a bone. All you need to do is listen, and the questions will come up. So The big tip I would give anyone who's starting out is when you first start in a sport, don't collect anything, and it'll be the best sports science you ever do. Just do a little bit of detective work, just listening to people, and they will give you your question. They will just hand it to you on a platter. And then the rest is a lot easier, the actual knowing what to collect. So rather than collecting a whole heap of data or a whole heap of numbers, knowing what to collect is will become a lot easier because you know what your question is. And then in terms of analyzing it, that actually becomes a lot easier too, because you know the right data, you know the question, you know the right data to collect. And then the actual analysis part is, right, well, this is the final part, this is the final piece of the puzzle, I can actually do this now. It's really easy once you know your question. That challenge that you know, you came across with that sports scientist is a really common challenge. So, you know, it's one that comes up a lot with different people I work with, the younger people who are starting out in the field. It's one that comes up a lot.
No, and it actually might seem a bit counterintuitive. You get hired as a sports scientist and you want to collect data, obviously, but at the same time, as you said, it's important to create those relationships, not only with the staff, but with the players, because if not, you're just collecting numbers and for the sake of numbers.
Yeah, maybe we call it the sports science paradox.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It's you're put in that role to do a certain job with numbers. But my experience is that you can, unless you can maintain relationships, unless you can develop relationships and maintain them and work with people, then, you know, all the numbers in the world, you can be as bright as you like with numbers, unless you can actually communicate what these numbers mean in a really user-friendly way, because a lot of the players and coaches don't have the same background in numbers that you might. But equally, unless you have a good feel for the game, which comes from just being around the game long enough and talking with different people who've been in the game a long time, then some of those numbers that you can analyze as long as you like, but they won't actually help you unless you've developed and maintained those relationships.
What are some of the pitfalls that can arise if you collect data, analyze it, and then create questions based off of the data rather than having an initial question and having the data answer it?
Look, I think, you know, as much as I see this a fair bit, actually, that a lot of people contact me and say, look, we've got all this data, we need some help writing it up. And I'm going, well, you know, my first thing is, what is your question? You know, what is your question that actually made you collect that data in the first place? And I see it a lot in different internships where teams will put on a sports science intern, and the intern is brought into the environment. They're given their tracksuit and their club hat, and they feel they've made it because they've got their tracksuit. But they're put in the corner of an office and said, here's the data. You go to town on that and see what you can find. And what it does is we actually create a really big problem that not only affects us now, potentially it's going to affect us in 20 years' time. Because we don't have a question, we don't really know what we're looking for in that data. So that's the first thing. We don't have a question. Second is we put someone with very little experience in that role. They might have good expertise with technology, but very little experience in statistical analysis or analyzing data, and it takes time to develop those skills. So they're just sort of fumbling around with the whole heap of numbers. Keep in mind, fumbling around with numbers and no question. But then the bigger issue is that down the track, we create a whole generation of sports scientists who have learned that just collecting a whole heap of numbers is what sports science is about. To me, it's not about that at all. To me, sports science is about using evidence in a practical way to make a difference to sport. And you won't find that definition in the Oxford Dictionary or anything, but that's what sports science is to me. You want to use evidence in a practical way to make a difference. And so if they haven't had some good mentoring in that early stages, then what we actually develop is a whole heap of people that collect a lot of numbers, and it's almost as if they use those numbers as a crutch rather than going, well, let's learn the sport. Let's learn the problems that the sport faces and the challenges of the sport, and let's develop our questions and around those problems. And then our next step is let's make sure the data we collect reflects those questions. So if we don't get it right, if we don't get that mentoring right now and get that process right with the next generation of sports scientists coming through, then I see potentially that being a problem in 20 years' time. A lot of good work that's been done, you know, over the last 20 or 30 years in sports science and the way sports scientists have worked, the really good applied sports scientists have worked, a lot of that really good work will be undone. And it'll just be, sports science will just be the people who deal with numbers rather, and they won't be allowed to interact with coaches. They won't be allowed to interact with players. All they'll be allowed to do is sit in an office and look at those numbers, which would be a really sad way for sports science to go, I think.
No, without a doubt. And at least from my perspective, it'd be a pretty boring job. You're just looking at numbers all day.
Absolutely. Yeah, I may as well become an accountant or I wouldn't like that. I wouldn't like that either.
I just want to get back to some of the audience questions because I want to make sure I answer as many of them as possible. So this one's from Jesse, and he said, what areas would you like to further explore in the new future in terms of your research and why?
Great question, Jesse. I don't really know. I guess it'll just it'll depend on what the next question is. I guess there's always going to be, I'll always have that theme around performance and probably, you know, fatigue and injury. And, you know, in general terms, that's where my research has been over the last 20 years, is around those themes. So it'll stay in that area. I've probably been pleasantly surprised, a little humbled by how important the acute chronic workload ratio has been and accepted amongst different sports. It's been really humbling to know that it's made so much common sense, and it's actually put it's made things a lot simpler for people working in sports. So that's been really positive. So, you know, I'd like to probably continue down that path. Equally, I'd like to keep the education around the importance of physically hard training. And, you know, I think if anything, that a training injury paradox paper is probably put that square and center is that we no longer have to think that we have to reduce training loads all the time to try and reduce injuries. And sometimes training harder is actually training smarter. And that's been a really positive thing as well. So I will continue down that path because it's actually a really important part of my philosophy, I guess, is that you need to know when to back off your players and need to know when to recover your players, but you also need to know when hard training is appropriate. And I'll continue down that path in terms of the research, but also in terms of an education, trying to educate, you know, a whole range of people. From players to coaches, to physiotherapists, to strength and conditioning staff, and how they fit on the continuum in terms of not only preparing players for the worst case scenario, but when players are in rehab, the importance of trying to get to high chronic loads and to build them safely, and also from a player's perspective to make sure that they understand the benefits that high loads can bring, that if they come back on day one of preseason in a reasonably good shape, they actually set themselves up to stay injury free for longer. So the education part's going to be a big thing for me as well.
Dr. Gabbett, we kind of touched upon this earlier in the podcast when we were talking about the young sports scientist, but I usually like to finalize all the podcasts by giving some recommendations to those who are just undergraduates or just had an internship or so. So what recommendations would you have for young coaches that are looking to get into to be an applied sports scientist?
The first thing I think they need to do is try and make themselves look a bit different from the hundreds and thousands of other undergraduates that are coming through those degrees. So the way they can do that is everyone's going to roughly have, you know, the same qualification, but the way they can make themselves look a bit different is to get some experience. And don't expect to walk into the highest level job and expect to be paid the highest salary. What I'd suggest they do is actually start at a really low level and get their experience at a low level, make some mistakes at a low level, because it in general terms it doesn't it's not life or death down there. Whereas if you make mistakes at an elite level, they get magnified, and it's not the kind of place that you want to be making mistakes. So first thing is get some experience, and the second thing is try and get involved with different projects that are going on around the place. So if they're interested in applied sports science, then different universities will have independent study units, so they can actually work with an applied sports scientist and develop a little project that they can do in a short period of time. But it gives them a taste of what applied sports science is about, and then they can actually learn whether they really like that area or whether they realize it's not for them. And probably the third thing I think is really important is to get some mentors or get a mentor that they trust, that but also that someone that's going to be honest with them about and give them some honest feedback, and that they're prepared to take some of that feedback as well. So someone who actually has enough experience of doing some things well and doing some things poorly and made some mistakes along the way that they can actually learn from, and when they've got a few challenges, a few questions, they can just ring that person up and have a little bit of a talk through some of those issues. So there's a couple of things that I think can probably help them as they're starting out in their career.
I actually have a quick follow-up question, and it's a follow-up question that I always ask when I hear go out and get a mentor, because in many respects it sometimes seems easy, like just find someone who has more experience and be able to shadow them, ask them questions, and receive constructive criticism from them. But it's sometimes very intimidating, especially when you're fairly young. So how would you recommend someone to try to connect with someone who could possibly be a mentor for them?
Yeah, look, I guess you're right. In thinking back, when I was starting out, it is intimidating to go up to someone at a conference or, and if you've read a lot of their work or, they're a keynote speaker or whatever. When you're younger, you tend to put them up on that pedestal or, you know, think that they're much greater than what they really are. But Now the shoe's on the other foot, I'm lucky enough to do some of those things and speak at conferences. I'll let everyone know that we're no different from anyone else. we're just we're just people, and we're definitely not gods. And I definitely don't put myself up on a pedestal, because it's what I actually find is, you know, someone told me once, be really good to people on your way up, because they're going to be the same people you meet on the way back down. And it's so true that you know, things can be really fickle. The world can be pretty fickle. So you know, that at one point in time you can be going along really well, and things can change pretty quickly. So you need to sort of remember who you are and where you've come from with a lot of this stuff. And I think what you'll find is the really good people. Good people, not necessarily good scientists, but good people will have all the time in the world for young people coming through that, you know, and they would actually be really flattered by you know, the suggestion that you know, that they mentor, you know, that all the, you know, the request that they mentor someone. So you know, I think as long as the younger, you know, undergraduate comes up and is respectful about you know, about what they want to achieve, and you know, if they and they, you know, they genuinely want to improve, and they're doing it for the right reasons. So they're not actually just doing it so they can get their tracksuit in high performance sport as soon as possible. They actually want to get better at what they do. They're prepared to do their time at a lower level. They're prepared to take advice. I actually think the majority of good people would be there to try and support them to get to that type of role, that type of position.
No, absolutely. Dr. Gabbett, if anyone has any questions or wants to reach out to you about anything that you said in the podcast, what's the best way they can do so?
Look, I think they're probably best to go through the website, and just if they go to gabbettperformance.com, they can just email me through the website, and I'll do my best to get back to them as quickly as possible.
Sounds perfect. I'll make sure to link that in the show notes. Do you have any events or conferences that you're going to be speaking at relative in the near future?
Yeah, there's always stuff going on. If in May in Australia, there's some sports medicine conference in Adelaide. There's also some sports science and workload monitoring workshops going on in the States in June, from around the, you know, early June. So if they keep an eye on the Twitter feed, I'll send some of those dates out as well.
Sounds great, and I'll link the Twitter feed as well.
Terrific.
Dr. Gabbett, it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast. I really appreciate it. I'm sure all of the listeners who asked questions appreciated your answer. So thank you.
Thanks very much, James. It's been a really good questions, and had a lot of fun with it. Thanks very much.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of the Historic Performance Podcast. If you enjoyed it, please make sure to head over to iTunes and leave a review and rating. It really helps others discover the show, and I greatly appreciate it. If you have any questions for Dr. Tim Gabbett, make sure to head over to his website, which is in the show notes, and shoot him an email. Or if not, try to contact him via Twitter. He'll be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have. I'll see you guys next week.